The 2010 Sydney Writers' Festival runs this week, and Radio National will be broadcasting on a designated digital channel from the Writers' Week all week. Look for ABC Sydney Writers on your digital radio screen to hear talks right through this week. We'll also be bringing you interviews with some authors here on Breakfast throughout the week, starting this morning with Michael Otterman, a freelance journalist and human rights consultant. He's the author of a new book called Erasing Iraq, The Human Cost of Carnage. Michael, thanks very much for joining us again on Breakfast.
Yeah, thanks for having me in.
The premise of your book, Erasing Iraq, is the litany of wrongs that the Iraqi people have suffered at the hands of foreigners. It's 7 years since the 2003 invasion of Iraq. There's still plenty of violence going on, as we hear every day or every week at least. But there is now some political stability. There have been elections recently, although they're still being resolved. Is Iraq a better place now than it was under Saddam Hussein in 2003?
Well, you have to look at the wider cost. Things are more stable today, certainly as they were right after the invasion. The rates of violence relative to the worst days of the post-invasion chaos are down. But what my book is about is the human costs. The costs have been tremendous. And, you know, as part of this book's research, I spent time in Syria and Jordan speaking to Iraqi refugees. And they were very quick to point out, you know, the trauma that they've experienced. Obviously, it endured under Saddam Hussein. And I include narratives of life under Saddam and torture that some people endured under Saddam. But there, in terms of U.S. aggression in that country, they pinpoint 1991 during the first Gulf War, and then the UN sanctions, and then finally 2003 in the post-invasion chaos as this real continuum of suffering. The costs have been tremendous, over 5 million displaced, millions killed. So it's really hard to compare apples to oranges, what's better, what's worse. Iraqis I spoke to, look, some supported the toppling of Saddam Hussein, but I didn't meet any Iraqi that supported this prolonged occupation.
Okay. Just the title itself, Erasing Iraq, what do you mean?
Well, we talk about the concept of sociocide in the book, and sociocide is a term which essentially reflects the killing of people and displacement, but also reflects the larger costs. And we argue almost the destruction of a society. And sociocide is an apt term to describe the level of destruction in Iraq. And it's akin to erasing Iraq, because not only do you have millions killed and millions displaced, but you have destruction of very basic and central elements of Iraqi life. Coming through, if you look at the religious and minorities in Iraq, we talk about the Mandaeans, which is a religious group that have lived, well, for centuries in Iraq. They numbered about 50,000 strong before 2003. And after 2003, they've just been obliterated by Sunni, Shia fundamentalists. Their numbers are about 4,000 or 5,000. Today, up, you know, down from 50,000, and they've had this almost global diaspora. They've been killed, kidnapped within Iraq, and this is a religious group that's unique to, or was unique to Iraq, which has been completely obliterated in the post-invasion chaos. Sociocide and erasing Iraq also refers to the destruction of cultural elements in the country, the destruction of shared artifacts, so things like the Baghdad Museum, which was sacked after the invasion. Over 9,000 artifacts are still lost and presumed destroyed. This reflects the wider cost of this war, which the term sociocide describes.
I suppose no one really thinks that any war has no costs. Mm-hmm. And here, sitting in the West, we think, well, perhaps it was worth it. Saddam has gone. These people are now holding relatively free and fair elections. It seems to be moving forward. I think one statistic that I read in your book that I hadn't really focused on much was the displacements, the displaced people, the amount of refugee people living, well, homeless within Iraq but outside of Iraq. It numbers in the millions, as you said.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredible number, and it's an incredible movement of people. It's the largest refugee crisis in the region since 1948 and the establishment of Israel. But it's almost an invisible crisis because, like I said, there's over 2 million externally displaced refugees. Most of them live in Syria and in Jordan. But unlike other refugee crises that maybe come to mind, these people aren't living in tents. They live in the outskirts of Damascus and Amman in kind of the rougher neighborhoods and the ramshackle buildings. Interestingly, these are mostly middle-class Iraqis, and many professionals and school teachers. These are actually the people that Iraq needs, certainly right now, to rebuild its society. But they remain displaced, and they, despite relative drops in violence, they choose not to return because they don't see a country, A, that's stable, and B, that has water, power, basic sewerage, the services.
So life is better in a sort of some kind of refugee situation in Syria or Iran or Jordan than it is.
That's right. I mean, there hasn't been massive returns. Actually, there's only been a trickle of returns.
The UNHCR estimates 2,000 Iraqis are returning each year.
Yeah, and when you look at the number, about 2 million externally displaced, that's really nothing. And in fact, there was less returns in 2009 than there was in 2008. And so they're digging into the neighboring states in around Iraq, and they're essentially just stuck there, living off their life savings, living off handouts from the UNHCR.
And they're not coming home because life in Iraq isn't too good, but how much are they not coming home because of the fear of the reprisals due to the religious unrest now? I mean, Iraq was famously quite a successful secular society.
That's right. I mean, before 1991, Iraq had the strongest public health system in the region, and healthcare is one of the strongest educational systems. And certainly all this Sunni Shia violence did not exist. This has all occurred after the invasion, as the U.S. literally empowered certain tribal sheikhs and religious leaders in their quest to stabilize, which they didn't really do successfully. But the end result of all this was this rise of fundamentalism, which has obliterated ethnic and religious groups like the Mandans, and still today, many people cannot return to their homes because for many people they don't have a home to return to. If it wasn't literally destroyed during the invasion or post-invasion, squatters have since moved in. Typically, it's people of the other religious sects because Baghdad had over 200 mixed neighborhoods before the war. Now there's only roughly 25 mixed neighborhoods. There's been a real polarization within Baghdad. So people can't just rock up to their old neighborhoods anymore because they've changed completely.
And we're seeing that in evidence in this latest election and the toing and froing over who won the election. Who did you speak to for this book?
Well, I spent some time in Syria, first in Damascus. Damascus hosts some of the largest populations of Iraqi refugees, and I went there in 2008 just to really collect stories about what life was like before, during, and after the invasion. You know, I should say that the whole idea for this book came from a very simple question: What do Iraqis think? What do they feel? Did they welcome this invasion? What is their life like now, before, during, and after? And the reason why we even had to ask this ourselves, because I didn't feel, and I have two co-authors on this project, we didn't feel that the media was sufficiently asking or answering this question. So I went out to Syria and Jordan. My co-author went to Sweden, which hosts one of the largest populations of Iraqi refugees in Europe, and just asked these very basic questions.
Okay, Michael, thank you very much for joining us on Breakfast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's Michael Otterman. He's a freelance journalist. His new book is called Erasing Iraq, and it's published by Pluto Press. And he's in town for the Sydney Writers' Festival. And it's, I guess, interesting to note that more than 2 months after the elections in Iraq, no group has yet assembled a parliamentary majority. And that second count has just gone on. It upheld the findings of the first recount. First count, sorry. You're listening to RN Breakfast. It's 8:23.